Our speaker for today is Lily S., so let's give her a hand as she comes up.
Well, good evening, everyone. And I know some of you out there know me as Lily Bear, and some of you know me as Lil. Unfortunately, you don't know me as anything else. I'm going to have to periodically put this scarf on. I recently had surgery on my hand, and I'm not supposed to keep it down. So if I suddenly do this, it's not that I'm trying to get your attention. It means my arm's hurting, and I need to get the blood flowing down. You know, coming into an Al-Anon meeting is like coming into a family. You always feel really welcomed. You always feel very at home. But I was telling Denise and Francis that I'm really nervous. And I always get nervous before I share anyway. So I'm going to be looking really weird here. First, my hand wrap and a fan. And, you know, if I periodically fan myself, I said I feel at home. So if I get too hot, I might do the armpits. So just excuse me because it does get warm. I was telling Denise that, and Denise said, well, just pretend like you're giving a lecture in a classroom. And so everybody get your notepads out and your pencils and start taking notes. No, I'm only kidding. I never know what story I'm going to start off with. Now, I'd like to see a show of hands. Anybody here only have one story? Exactly. So we never know what we're going to share. We never know what God's going to put in this little brain of mine and have me share with you guys. But I come from a long line of alcoholics, and I know I'm not alone in that. Can I have some water? I'm getting a little dry throat. Please. Thank you. Thank you, Willie. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I grew up in a kind of a confusing alcoholic home. I say confusing because my dad had this job that allowed him to have diplomatic immunity. So when I grew up, I got used to him getting into accidents and, you know, drunk driving and totaling cars out. And the police would bring him home, and they would ask my mom if she needed anything. Did she have to go to the store? So to me, I'm thinking, okay, something doesn't quite click here because my dad's out there destroying things, and yet he's getting treated so nicely. So it was rather confusing to me, but there was a part of me that thought, this still isn't right. There's something not quite right with this. Because I think even though you grow up in an alcoholic home, anybody here grow up in an alcoholic home? Anyone who maybe didn't grow up in your younger years in an alcoholic home, but when you got married, you felt like you were growing up in an alcoholic home? Yeah, there's quite a few of us of those, yeah. Thank you. But anyway, it was kind of a crazy, crazy world, and I think I'm not the only one that probably felt this way, that I really thought my dad drank because my mother was crazy. I didn't realize my mom was crazy because my dad was drinking. She did a lot of strange things. Today, she's still alive and well, 89 years old, kicking, and she'll be 90 in December. And she, you know, when I was growing up, I didn't always really care for her. I didn't really have a warm place in my heart for her. Because one of the things that would happen is, because of the insanity in the home, sometimes what would happen, I would walk in, and I didn't know if I was going to get a blow to the head or be smothered with kisses and hugs. And today, because of being in program, my mother and I have a very loving and caring relationship. I make sure she gets her medication. I make sure she gets to her doctors. It's so different, and I'm actually happy to see her. I don't even call her mom anymore. I call her Mamacita. And we get along really, really well. And if it wasn't for this program, that relationship would have never healed. It never would have gotten better. With my dad was a little bit of a different story. With my dad, when I was 9 years old, they gave him 6 months to live. However, we know everything happens in God's time, not in the doctor's time. And he lasted 10 more years. He had cancer. The doctors don't know how he lasted. He smoked. He drank. I don't know if he did drugs or not. I have no clue. But he pretty much destroyed his body, but it lasted for another 10 years of, you know, just physical abuse that he did to himself. And I remember that the relationship I had with my dad was very different. As a young little infant, if you will, or toddler, my dad was one person I looked up to. You know, when you're a toddler, you look up always to, well, you have to, your height alone, you have to do that. But the relationship we had was my dad was never the disciplinarian, you know. And one day he came home and he was just completely inebriated. And I still have that habit once in a while, putting my hands on my hips, you know, when I am disgusted with something. And here I am, this three-year-old, and I put my hands on my hips and I just called him a drunk. And that I was really upset with him. And he just kind of looks down, I think, and he didn't know what to take of it. But he was pretty drunk, so he didn't know what he was doing. But he just backhanded me as hard as he could. It was the first time I'd ever gotten hit by him. And at that time, you know, what alcoholism does to us as children is we don't know how it starts to change our personality. It starts to change our inner core of who we are. And I was always this really happy, silly, you know, giddy little baby running all over the place. When that happened, I didn't talk to him or acknowledge him for 2 weeks. He'd walk in the room, I'd walk out. He'd sit at the dinner table, I'd get from the dinner table and we'll leave. This is at 3 years old. I'm already learning how to react and try to be passive aggressive and all of this other crazy behavior. At that young of an age, I'm doing these bizarre things. And so what happened was, I didn't know at that time, but when we moved my mom out of the house, I'm giving away my age, but that's okay. I just turned 60 last week. and in 1953, that's when I was 3 years old, my dad went to AA. And I had no idea. And my mom said, yes, it was after he hit you, he felt so horrible. It didn't last long, but when we moved my mom out, we found a 1953 AA directory. Couldn't believe it. Shocked me because I had no idea. I never knew my dad had ever attempted to find sobriety. I had no clue whatsoever. Not until it's been about 5 or 6 years when we sold my mom's house and moved her out. So, you know, more always gets revealed. You just never have a clue what your family secrets are. I mean, how many people here have family secrets? Oh, come on now. Some of you guys aren't raising your hand. Give me a break here. but, you know, these were one of those secrets that never get told. And it just amazes me how we change, how we just sometimes evolve negatively. And sometimes I think truly God always puts people in your life and tries to get you on that right path. And one of the people my God, of my understanding, put in my life was about 4 years old, my mom sent for my grandmother. My parents are from El Salvador. And my grandmother came out, and she was giving me spiritual guidance. She was giving me, you know, she was giving me the child rearing I really needed, because I couldn't get it from my mom. I couldn't get it from my dad. But thank God, he saw fit to put the idea in my mom's head to send my grandmother. Sadly, she didn't last very long. She ended up dying of cancer also. But she gave me tools. She gave me tools on how to learn and how to live a life differently than what I was living in. In some ways, it was really good, but it also created this wonderful tool for me to fall into this world of denial. You know, growing up in that home gave me a lot of good tools and a lot of bad tools. And as I got older and decided that I'm sure I'm not the only one in this room who also has said, I will never, ever get involved with an alcoholic or drug addict. Right? Can I see a show of hands how many had that said that? And I swore I would never, ever in my life get involved with an alcoholic or a drug addict. So, of course, high school, his drinking bothered me. My freshman year in college, I met this guy, and I wasn't sure what was wrong. I just knew something was off, but I didn't know what. So, of course, that was an attraction to me because there was something just about him that I just thought was really kind of neat, but I didn't know what it was. That was kind of interesting because I grew up when, you know, the hippies and the commune, and, you know, and I actually lived in one in the foothills of Glendora. And it was really kind of funny because it wasn't funny, but when you think about how God puts us all together, there was a group of us, about eight of us, that decided we're going to create this commune up in the foothills of Glendora, and we're going to raise our own veggies and, you know, eat really healthy and, you know, just do all these things that were just down to nature. And every single one of us came from an alcoholic home. And one of our rules in this commune, that there wasn't going to be any drugs allowed, there wasn't going to be any booze allowed, there wasn't going to be any of this free sex stuff. We were truly going to be a commune. We're going to grow our veggies, we're going to be healthy, and, you know, screw the whatever. That lasted about 6 months. We each gradually start dating guys that were doing drugs or drinking, and the next thing you know, we're growing marijuana in the backyard. So, you know, that didn't last very long at all. So the next thing we find out is, you know, we figure, okay, well, you know, the next move is, why don't we get married? So we decide to get married. We went to Whittier and got married in the park. And this is before people got married in the park. So we had to get a permission to riot. That's actually what they say we had to have before we could get married in the park. And as I, you know, started noticing, there was something was progressively getting wrong with this guy. But I never saw bottles of booze, you know, occasionally maybe one beer or something like that. But I just knew there was something that, you know, wasn't right. And I crack up because I think about, you know, how many of us think about those moments when we should have gone, duh, what is going on here? But sometimes he would call me at work, and the conversation would be, and I'm thinking, what was that? I couldn't quite make it out. But I had, you know, suddenly it started dawning on me, something's not right here. And it's like, okay. Then that's when I realized he was addicted to prescription drugs. And as that addiction got worse, he started to drink. And then when that wasn't enough, he decided to find other areas and seedy locations to get the drugs of his choice that would help him. And he had this habit of, he came from a very affluent family, so he had this habit of spending a lot of money that he didn't have, writing checks that wouldn't go very far. And apparently this one time he wrote this one too many bad checks to this drug dealer. And the guy wasn't exactly very pleased with him. And we were married a little, maybe close to almost a year and a half, not quite yet. And I had one of those dumb moments. Suddenly, my husband, well, my future ex-husband, comes running through the door, the front door. We had this little foyer. He puts his back against the door, and he puts his feet up against the hall closet, and he's bracing it. And I'm thinking, okay, this can't be good. This cannot be good. And then suddenly there's a banging on the door, and it's his drug dealer. And the guy is screaming and yelling at the top of the lungs, and he says he's going to come in, he's going to rape me, and then he's going to kill him, and that he's effing tired of, you know, all the effing stuff that's effing going on. He just keeps talking about fornication all the time. And then all of a sudden, he, because this guy's pretty high himself, he hits the door as hard as he can, and it goes off the complete frame. And so all I see is the door pushing open, And this mad, high, loaded man, you know, with his look of rage in his face. And I am freaking out, to say the least. So at this point, I think I better go call the police. I pick up the phone, I call the police, and I don't even remember back then if there was 911 or not. But anyway, I call the police, and the lady on the line says, "Stay on the line, stay on the line." I said, "I can't stay on the line, I'm afraid. He said he's going to kill me, he's going to rape me, I'm really frightened. I better not stay on the line, I better go see what's going on." And so I take the phone over to the door, and she's saying, "Just stay on the phone, the police will be there shortly." I said, "They're not here yet, I'm really worried. I said, "I'm going to go get my gun." She says, "Don't get your gun." I said, "I got to go get my gun, I got to protect myself." She says, "No, don't get your gun, stay on the phone, the police will be there shortly." I said, no, I'm going to go get my gun. So I went and got my gun, and I go open to the door. As soon as it opened, I start shooting the gun. And she says, "What is that noise?" And I said, "That is my gun." And she says, "What is it?" I said, "It's my staple gun." So every time the door would open, I'd shoot staples at this guy. And to my surprise, not to my surprise, really, I remember seeing him going like, because I'm sure he's probably trying to figure out, why are these staples coming at me? So then the police show up, finally, and it sounds like, of course, there's about 10,000 cars outside, and I hear these shotguns, you know, cocking, and it sounds like 1,000 shotguns out there. And he says, "Put your hands up, MF-er." So what do? I put my hands up because I have no idea if I'm the MF-er or the guy out there is the MF-er. I'm not going to take a chance. I'm going to put my hands up. I must have had my hands up 10 or 15 minutes. They had arrested him. They had put him away, but they hadn't been in the house, and I'm still standing there because I'm afraid they're going to shoot me. And they finally came in and tell me, you know, "Put your arms down, honey. We're not going to shoot you." But at that time, what had happened was the police came in, and because of the laws, because he didn't hurt us, he didn't injure us, he didn't do any harm. So therefore, they could only hold him for 24 hours. And so they told us we better move out. At that moment, it dawned on me, I need a divorce. And that's when I decided to divorce him. And so we were married about a year and a half, and I decided to go on my merry way. And after that divorce, there's too many stories in between there. I jokingly refer to it as my sleazette phase. And I was just looking for love in all the wrong places. And I don't think I'm the only one that's ever done that. And as a result of that, at one moment, I remember thinking to myself, God, you know, what is going on? What do? I've always believed in you. I've always talked to you every night. I've given you the to-do list. I know you don't pay attention to me because nothing ever gets done on my to-do list. But please, just guide me. I don't know what to do. And at this moment, I really hit, I think, my Al-Anon bottom. And I'm sure my neighbors thought I was, you know, out to lunch myself. Because at that point, aside from getting a divorce, aside from having to find a place to move to within 24 hours, aside from all of those things, the company I was working for went out of business. So I was unemployed. I showed up one day and the doors were locked. And I thought to myself, okay, now what do? So I decided to get divorced, move to Belmont Shores. That's when it was affordable. And go on unemployment. Eventually I found a job, but at that point when I was hitting my Al-Anon bottom, my emotional bottom, I remember one evening crying so hard, I talk about drama queen. I just lifted up the window in my apartment, stuck my head out. I said, God, I surrender. I don't know what to do. My arms are up in the air. Tears are running down my face. And I just was in so much pain. I had no clue where to go and what to do. And the next morning, got myself together and I found a job. I thought, okay, well, maybe things are looking good. And at this job, I was doing okay, went on. And I don't think anybody, I'm sure I'm not alone in this one either. When I went to the job, I was very arrogant, smug, self-righteous, and a little dominating. And when I used to go for job interviews, I would interview the company. I would turn it around so I'd be interviewing them instead of them interviewing me. And it was kind of a neat technique because I always seemed to get the job that way. So I ended up at this company, and I would get home at night, and I would still cry, and I'd have to stop at 10 o'clock because if I didn't stop crying at 10, the next day when I got to work, my eyes would be too puffy. Then somebody told me about a trick about tea bags. And I thought, oh, okay, so I can cry a little longer. but I kept doing this. I just kept doing this over because I was just miserable. But when I showed up for work, I had a smile on my face. I was in a good place. Nobody had any clue how much pain and how much of a big abyss my soul felt. Like there was nothing there. There was so much emptiness, so much hollowness. But I could come up to you and I could smile at work and I could just be okay and nobody was the wiser. And I kept praying at night, and again, my list to God didn't get done. And then we got this phone man assigned to our department. Now, normally, I'm not attracted to the way this phone man looked. I tended to be attracted to men about my height, a little on the small frame, dark hair. Well, this phone man was quite the opposite. To me, he was tall. He was 5'10". To me, that's tall. And very buff. He lifts weights, you know, so... light kind of brownish hair, and everyone in my department's telling me, you know, this guy's got the hots for you. I said, he's not my type. Oh, he's not my type. Oh, he's not my type. And then one day we were going to a party for one of the ladies at work, and he asked me out that night, and so, you know, being a liberated, independent, stubborn woman, I said to him, I said, I'm not going to go on a date because I don't give up friends. When I have an appointment or I have an event with a friend, I don't give it up for a date. So you're welcome to come to the party if you want, but don't consider it a date. So we met there, and a few dates later, I joked that I fell in love at first kiss. And I was really surprised. Because he was very different. He was a gentle soul. He was very thoughtful, well-mannered, always opened the door for me. Very gentle man on a six-month dry, which I didn't know. And so once I got hooked and once I was really, you know, falling in love with this guy, he tells me, and, you know, I think you can relate to this. Growing up in an alcoholic home, often we don't think drinking a lot of alcohol is a big deal because you're so used to seeing people drinking a lot of alcohol. So he says, you know what? He says, I don't really have a drinking problem, but I think I'm just going to drink some near beer. And you know what? I think I'm just going to drink some beer. You know what? I think I'm just going to drink some wine. By now, I've fallen in love with this guy. Next thing I know, he's on bourbon, wine, anything he can consume. And, of course, me not having any kind of recovery thinks, what do we think? If we marry him, they will? Yeah, stop drinking. And so, despite the fact that he was falling down drunk our wedding day, I still thought that I could, you know, get this guy sober. And what happened was on our honeymoon, we went to the wine country. And All right, there's this picture of us getting on the boat to Alcatraz, and it has, and it's got Bob and I, and they took the picture with the bars in front of us. We still have that picture because we laugh about it. Because I remember I'm pissed because he's so drunk. And the night before, I think he picked this really romantic restaurant so that we could eat together and just overlook the bay and, you know, watch the seals in San Francisco. And just, I thought, what a wonderful guy. I did marry the right guy. And the only reason why he picked that restaurant, because he'd been there before. The only reason why he picked that table before, or picked that table, because he was there before. And it's because it had a big bush, and that's where he hid his bottle of bourbon so he could slip it into his coffee. So I'm pissed. So I have this look of, you know, as I'm getting on this boat, and his look is like, oh my God, I'm in real big trouble, you know. So we still laugh about that picture today. But by the time we were 11 months married, I was done. I thought, okay, I can't stay with this guy. I cannot do this. I saw what it did to my mom. I saw what it did to my sister. I see that my brother has run away from us emotionally, physically, has no contact from us whatsoever, which I can't blame him because of the insanity of the alcoholism in our family. So at 11 months, I'm thinking I'm going to divorce this guy. It's all over with. And he's been trying to get sober at different places, and I'm thinking he's not going to get sober. One more time, he's going to try another place. One more place, one more place, one more place, one more place. It's not going to happen with this man. And we end up at this hospital in Orange County, and that's where he got sober. And I really didn't think he was going to get sober, but oddly enough, he has not had a drink now for 23 years. And, but you know, I remember that time of going into the hospital and seeing him. And I did that pseudo face. And, you know, in my mind, and I know I'm not the only one again, that, you know, in our mind, we're going, you SOB, you son of a this, you effing this, you know, we're calling them all sorts of fornicating words and fecal matter and you name it. And, you know, we just cuss in our head. And but yet when I would see him, I'd have this smile on my face, you know, this loving smile. And in the back of my head is, you don't have any clue, I'm leaving you. I'm not sticking around. I am out of here. And I had good plans. I had big plans. My hairdresser, my gay hairdresser, and I were going to move to Colorado and raise Cocker Spaniels. That was our goal. And that didn't pan out, but, you know, my husband today and the relationship we have today is very different, very different. Program has taught me so, so much. The very first meeting I ever went to taught me about service. The second meeting I ever went to taught me about the true meaning of these rooms and how recovery really heals the pain, the abyss, the hole, you know, all those things that we think are never going to go away. And the very first meeting, the reason why I say taught me about service, and I, you know, as Willie knows, you know, we're very much into service. First 5 years of my program, I was very involved in intergroup. And for about 15 years, I did world service. After that, I stopped. And the reason why I stopped was I started having to care for my mom. And my husband, I actually was planning on stopping because about 5 years ago, my husband was diagnosed with early stages of dementia and Parkinson's. And I was joking because if I have tissues, I don't cry. But I might still cry. Yeah, here they come. They gave him 5 years. And today, You know, it's God's time. It's not the doctor's time, just like with my dad. Today, he's still able to go to the grocery store. He's still able to do the laundry, you know. There's a bit of age difference between us. He's 71. And, you know, he's still functioning. But I can see the deterioration. I can see them increasing his medication. And I know someday he's going to be gone. And what this program taught me was to create memories. Loving, kind, wonderful, heartfelt memories with this man. Who after 11 months, I could not stand the sight of him. I could not stand the touch of him. And it's so different today. I love that man with all my heart. But I've also learned in this program to love myself. And I gotta say, I know I'm not the only one again, that, you know, he has good days and bad days. And it was, even on his good days, sometimes he can walk in the room and he can just walk in the room wrong. You know? He can just maybe sit in his chair wrong. You know, we all have those moments when the people we love with all our heart just piss us off, you know. And you know, I've learned that here, that it's just okay. It's just those moments. It doesn't mean I'm going to leave him. It doesn't mean I'm going to divorce him. It doesn't mean that, you know, it means that I'm going to stay. You know, that these moments the program has taught me. One of the things I've learned, serenity is not freedom from the storm. Serenity is peace amid a storm. That's what program has taught me. Program has taught me that there are good days and there are bad days. There are days when I just feel like so joyful and so happy. And there's some days that I'm just exhausted. But, you know, one of the things I found that I learned about myself, because someone asked me once, they said, you know, how do you do it, Lil? How do you take care of your mom? And how do you deal with Bob and his health? And I said, you know, I have to look at it as God gave me a gift. God chose me. And I feel blessed to put this man in my life, to put the mom I have in my life, because he knew I was going to care for them. He knew that I wasn't going to run at the first sight of, you know, illness or whatever. I'm in there for the long term with him. And, you know, we joke and we laugh today, and sometimes he jokes, and, you know, sometimes he'll joke about his memory, and it's hard sometimes to hear him because Parkinson's affects the vocal cords, and it's hard to hear. But Parkinson's is a result of alcoholism. It's a common disease with alcoholics who drank hard, and Bob drank hard, very, very hard. He sometimes jokes now today, and he kind of laughs, and because when I first met him, and we were first going to move in together before we got married, you know, I did the little hip thing. Ooh, that hurt my hand. I guess I get to do the hip thing this way. I said to him, he says, well, you know, I want us to live together, so, you know, what do you think? And I said, okay, here are my terms. I am not a domestic goddess. You will clean the toilets. I hate cleaning toilets. We will both cook. We will both clean. We will both go to taking things to the cleaners. I said, this is a united front. I said, again, I am not a domestic goddess. And I, you know, I can count on the number of my hands, the number of meals I've cooked for this poor man. Everything is microwaved. My motto is, if I can't nook it, I can't cook it. But, you know, I'm really, truly blessed. And sponsorship has given me many things. I know when, you know, I'm feeling a little annoyed with Bob, one of my sponsees will call who has a spouse with similar problems, you know, and it puts me right back where I need to be. And I know if I was not in this program, I would not be able to be caregiving for these two people in my life today, who I love with all my heart. I would not be able to do it. I probably would have been long gone. And I was wondering, I'd be wondering why I would feel so horrible about myself, you know. But today I can look at myself in the mirror. I can walk tall. I can, you know, God has done so much for me that faith, I've truly learned the definition of blind faith. I truly know what it means. And, you know, I get amazed sometimes because things happen. At the place I work, there was a situation, and I didn't want to be in that situation anymore, so I switched departments, and I took a big cut in pay, and I just trusted God that it was going to be okay. Well, exactly 1 year later, I got offered another position, and back in the department I was in before, at a lot more money than what even the amount that I had lost. You know, and I just kind of sat there and I smiled and they said, obviously you're really happy about this. And I'm just thinking, you know what? God's got my back. That's what I know. That's what faith is about. God has got your back, always. May not seem like it. His answer is yes, no, and wait and see. And I've always found the wait and sees are far better than the yeses and nos. Because it's just amazing when we wait to see what happens. I'm still waiting to see what else he's got in store for me because I'm just thrilled to death. I'm just thrilled to death of the stuff I have. Yes, I have a heavy heart for my husband, but you know, when I go home, I'm happy that I'm with him. When I talked to the phone on the phone today, he forgot to do some things and he felt really bad. He goes, oh, I'm so sorry, Lord. You know, I couldn't remember. It's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. Just tell him, we'll do it tomorrow. Mañana, you know, it's just okay. This program has given me so many wonderful life lessons. I feel so incredibly blessed, and I feel so so grateful that I got the faith that I have today, that I truly, truly trust God. Now, there are days, because I'm human, that God will whisper in my ear, Lil, don't do that. Lil, go over here. No, Lil, not over there, over here. And what he has to do is sometimes shout because I won't listen. So I know that I'm not the only one that has that little bit of a stubborn streak, that sometimes we get that guidance, you know, the door opens. I want to go out the window. Yes, it's a lot easier to walk through that door, but I want to go out the window. It's more exciting. It's more fun. I want to go out the window. So, you know, I still, even when I do those things and I realize God is talking to me, I just say, God, just watch my back. I know you don't want me to go through the window. I know you want me to go through the door, but just watch my back for me. I just want to go off on this little adventure and see what it's got in store for me. Just watch over me. Just protect me. Yeah. And I've learned, too, that to welcome God everywhere. I remember that from my first sponsor. She's passed away after being my sponsor for about 18 years. And she died from cancer. And, you know, she used to always say, well, don't forget to welcome God. Don't forget to welcome God. So whenever I start a job or a new department, I literally go into every single room, even the bathroom, and I just say, God, you are welcome here. Protect everyone who walks through here. Watch over everyone who comes through here. And just keep them safe. And please, just help us do your work. And then I'll go to the next room. And I'll say the same thing. And the next room. And I'll say the same thing. And when I start feeling the area getting heavy, I'll do it again and I'll go through. And sometimes there's been some really heavy stuff at work, you know, and I just kept trusting God, it's going to be okay. And the people who were the heavier, negative environment are now gone. I'm still there. Some of the new person has come in. It's a little bit lighter, a little bit more spiritual, you know. So the wait and see, like I said, is just amazing. Thank you very much, and I truly wish you all God-filled days. Thank you.